Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we're pleased to have Andrew Porter as our guest in the first part of the story. He's a writer, has won a number of awards for his work, including the Flannery O'Connor Award for 2007 for his short story collection, The Theory of Light and Matter. This is published by the University of Georgia Press. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Author's Corner. He teaches creative writing. He is on faculty of Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, where he is assistant professor of English and creative writing. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and has had a number of fellowships for his work. His fiction has appeared in One Story, Epoch, and the Pushcart Prize Anthology, also on NPR's Selected Shorts. And we're glad he could be here and spend a little time with us talking about his writing. Questions, of course, are welcome. People who are interested can call in and talk with our guest. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you could certainly use that number. That is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. I think I was thinking that maybe one of the first things I might ask is for you to talk a little bit about your attraction to stories, to shorter form. And then I sort of thought, well, you know, I never, if I would have a novelist on, and I guess I've had some chance to talk with some novelists, I'd never say, so what makes you want to write such a long book?
But, right.
but anyway, is there something in particular about the story as a form that really attracts you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, short stories were the first, pieces of literature that I was drawn to as a writer. And when I think back on my early influences, it was, you know, the stories of Raymond Carver and John Cheever and Flannery O'Connor and these types of writers that really made me want to become a writer and drew me to writing in the first place. And I think for me, what's really wonderful about the short story form, or what I like about it so much, is that it's a sort of brief glance into a character's life. And oftentimes, short stories are about characters who you only want to spend a short amount of time with. You know, they're not the types of characters who you would necessarily, you know, who would, you know, be interesting, you know, for the length of, say, a novel, or who you'd want to read about for the length of a novel. And also, I think there's something about the short story form. It forces you to focus on character, which is really what interests me as a writer. You know, novels are much more interested in plot, and you have to think a lot more about plot. And I've never been as interested in plot. And with a short story, there's such minimal plot, in some cases, you know, virtually no plot, that the focus is really on character. And for me, that's what excites me about the form. I really like, you know, discovering these characters and sort of, digging deep inside their, inside them and sort of figuring out who they are and so forth.
Yeah. I was, in fact, I was, one of the things I was thinking about was these particular characters and how, as a reader, I responded to them. And one of the things that I thought, I guess the thing that initially I thought was that I found myself generally liking the people in the stories. Now, I suppose there are times when you read people that the characters are maybe intentionally unlikable. The writer does not want you to like them. But I guess I found myself drawn to these people. And as I thought more about that, I thought maybe it was because they seemed to be in many ways very average.
Right.
and the kind of experiences that they were talking about were not truly exceptional. But they were things that you could imagine having lived through. Maybe we have lived through some of these things, or that you might say, "Well, that sounds like someone I know." There's something about these characters that are very accessible, and I think their ordinariness is part of the appeal.
Yeah, I think I think it was Chekhov who said, "You don't have to write about extraordinary characters to write extraordinary stories. And, you know, when I think again about sort of the writers that influenced me, Raymond Carver in particular, you know, he's one of the things that drew me to his work was the fact he was writing about everyday people. And these were not extraordinary people, but somehow he made extraordinary stories out of their lives. And, you know, that's something that I think about a lot with my own work.
Mm-hmm. Something else that I think really strikes me, and I don't know that it's true in all of these stories, but it seems to be true in a lot of these stories, and that is the perspective. And they are, it's someone who is telling you a story about something that happened in their past. They're very, it's a backward glance kind of a thing,
right,
which I think is interesting for a number of reasons. It gives you a chance to do a number of things. But just as a general question, is there something about that kind of posture that, you know, that turning back and thinking about something in the past that you find particularly interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I think the book is a lot of, you know, largely about memory. And many of the characters in the book are characters who are still kind of stuck in the past and trying in some way to deal with something, you know, traumatic or some type of event in their past that they still don't understand. And, you know, at the same time, trying to move forward and deal with the conflicts in their current lives. And I've always been interested in the relationship between past and present and the role of memory and storytelling. And so that theme carries, you know, throughout the book.
Yeah. So I think that certainly that was one of the things that really struck me, is that this kind of attitude, this kind of way of looking back at things does give you a chance to say something about memory. And maybe one of the first things that comes to mind is how unreliable memory is.
Right.
and we have, you know, there are at least a couple of stories where somebody is talking about an event in the past and suggesting that different versions of a particular event. And as if, and you don't know whether, do they truly not know? Are they messing with you as the reader? Are they messing with themselves? Basically, where they're talking about something that happened, and they said at one point, they said, well, it could have happened like this, but then it could have happened like this. But then again, it could have happened like this. And so it makes you wonder, well, what is it that they're really, what is it that they really believe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, is something that has always interested me when I think about stories, you know, what is true. And so often, you know, when we think back on events in our past, we don't really know. There's often a lot of mystery or a lot of ambiguity surrounding, you know, various things that have happened to us. And so we speculate and we try to figure it out as a way of getting at the truth of it. And so I think in the stories, I'll present various versions of an event as a way of showing what might have happened, but also creating a greater ambiguity and complexity in the story, and so that the reader at the end is not completely sure. And part of that is, you know, because I think in some ways we never completely know the truth about certain events, and so that's why I do that.
Yeah. Well, and would you at the end like to have the reader still have questions about the events, perhaps, or about the person?
Absolutely. I mean, I like, you know, I like the fact, you know, one of the things I go for in my stories is I want readers at the end to not be completely sure and to still have certain questions and for certain questions to still remain unanswered. And one of the questions I frequently get when I, you know, speak with students who have read my book or I, you know, give a reading is people want to know what's the real, you know, mm-hmm. what's the answer? And I always say, you know, I don't know myself. You know, I'm part of this is, you know, it's part of what I'm doing is trying to create questions at the end of the stories and leave it up to the reader to make their own decision.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, let me just introduce, is Andrew Porter. He is the author of the story collection, The Theory of Light and Matter. Won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction in 2007?
Yeah.
Is that right? It's published by the University of Georgia Press. He teaches at Trinity University. That's in San Antonio, Texas, where he is assistant professor of English and creative writing. He's here visiting in our area. We'll be doing a book signing this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Illini Union Bookstore, so anybody who is interested in attending should stop by. And, of course, you can go and look for his book. And questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Did you, at some point, did you make up your mind that you wanted to write? Was this something that, always was in your mind that you wanted to be a writer?
No, actually. I mean, I think back on my life and I always knew I wanted to do something artistic. When I was a young child, I was very interested in visual art. And, in high school, I was very interested in music and writing music. And when I entered college, I actually thought I was going to be a film major. And I didn't really get interested in writing until maybe my sophomore year of college when I took a creative writing class. I started writing some stories, and I sort of fell in love with the short story form. And I also had, some professors who were very encouraging, and it was the first time in my life that someone had been encouraging to me, about something I was doing artistically. So I thought, well, maybe this is something I could do. And the more I wrote, the more I just became drawn to it. And so it wasn't really till, maybe my last year or close to my last year of college that I began to think that this was something I wanted to do as a career.
Yeah. Wait, was your interest in film as a film scholar, or were you thinking you would want to be a filmmaker?
Filmmaker. Film is one of my great loves, and I really like the idea of being able to one day make films. But I soon realized, I started taking courses toward a film major, and I soon realized that if you're going to make a film, you have to be responsible for, a cast and a crew, and, you're kind of a leader of a group. And I realized I was much more, I enjoyed sort of creating art on my own, and that I was probably not going to be that good at sort of leading a group.
Yeah, you talked a little bit earlier, I asked right at the beginning about your interest in stories, and you said that one of the things about stories is that there's so much about character. When you're writing something longer, you certainly have to have characters, but there's much more has to go on. You have to do a lot more storytelling, and with the short story, the story, what happens, the action in the story can be relatively simple, and in fact, it can be so bare bones as there almost is no story. But what it's about is it's about the people, the characters. So in your approach to character, how do you develop that? Where do your characters, do you think, where do they come from?
That's a good question, again, that's a question I get a lot at readings. People will assume that the characters in my stories perhaps are people that I know or people from my lives. And it drives my parents crazy because they they say, I'm not like that. I have to explain this is fiction and, this is characters not meant to resemble you. But, I think that my characters are largely composites of a lot of people I've met in my life. And they're also, original creations. And so, in terms of discovering a character, usually, in an early draft of the story, I have just a very general sense of who that character is, and I sort of paint the character with very broad strokes. And then as I revise the story more and as I, put the character into more situations and as I reflect more on that character's life, they begin to take on layers and become more complex and, they begin to have more contradictions and in that way become more human, or begin to seem more real, and so it's a process of it's through the revision process that I ultimately discover who the character is.
Would you do the? Are they the characters more fully realized in your mind than they end up being in the story? That is, if we sat you down and I picked one of the characters from the book, and I said something like, "Well, tell me some more about this person that is not in this story." Could you do that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, and I talk to my students about this a lot. I say, you should know much more about the character than your reader does. And I think that that's important. And you should know details about their lives that maybe never appear in the story. And one of the things I do in the early drafts of writing a story is I'll just write about a character's life. And I might write about some aspect of their life that I kind of know in the back of my mind is not going to make its way into the story, like their job or something. And I'll write about their job and think about their job. And that helps me come to know the character, even though that content that I'm producing is not going to make its way into the story. And so, I think as a writer, you need to know a lot more about your characters than what you ultimately tell the reader. Yeah.
So then even when you're writing that, you're saying to yourself, or you have in your mind, well, I know later on this is I'm going to cut this out because it doesn't really – it serves a purpose for me, but for the reader it doesn't – maybe it's nice, but it really doesn't serve a purpose.
Right, yeah. And, you know, I don't know that I don't write in the fastest way. And, you know, one of the reasons for that is I spend, you know, I write really long, sort of unwieldy first drafts. And one of the things I'm doing is kind of just trying to get to know the characters. And, you know, oftentimes I'll wake up and I'll just start writing about some aspect of the character's life. As I said, that won't make its way into the story, but that is kind of interesting to me or that I want to know something more about. And like I said, it's not the fastest way to write a short story, but it helps me get to know the characters. Yeah.
Well, I think that's interesting to know that detail, and it makes me think about the fact that I'm sure I as a reader, other people as a reader, you approach the whatever it is, the story or the novel or whatever or the poem, as a finished form, what it finally comes to be. And maybe unless you're a writer yourself, unless you have done that, I don't think that you have a sense of all of the work and all of the struggle that got to that point. Everything that was written down at one point that ends up being thrown away. Everything that the writer decided that he or she needed to know that they never get around, and maybe for good reason, never get around to telling you. All of that work, as a reader, you really don't see it and you don't think about it.
Yeah. I heard, I think, an interview once or read an interview once with Tobias Wolff where he was asked about his student stories, and he said the thing that he noticed the most is that the student stories were underwritten. And he meant not that they needed to be longer, but that the students hadn't written enough about the characters and come to know them enough to really, you know, present them in a compelling way. And I think that's true. And you hear that with a lot of short story writers, how they'll start with, you know, a draft that's, say, you know, a first draft that's 60 pages for a story that's going to end up being 15. And, you know, I think that's what Tobias Wolff was talking about, is that you don't see that as that frequently.
One thing this is an odd sort of a question, but it seemed to me that in reading the book, there are, if you ask about what it is that a lot of people in the book do for their careers, there seem to be a lot of doctors in here, and there are a lot of college professors, and that just made me want to ask, do you have a lot of doctors and college professors in your family?
Well, my father was a doctor. He's retired now. And so I grew up, obviously, observing him and his life, but also, you know, his colleagues and partners and you know, other people in our neighborhood and so forth. So I grew up around a lot of doctors, and that's one of the reasons that doctors, you know, tend to appear pretty frequently in the stories. You know, I am a college professor, so, you know, inevitably that world also kind of creeps in to the stories. And, you know, I think ultimately you write about worlds that you know and that are familiar to you, and so inevitably, you know, some of these things come into the book.
Yeah. They also, the stories to me have a, I'm not exactly sure how I would describe it, but they certainly do seem to me have a fairly consistent tone.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe you have words to describe what it is. And I wonder, is that something that you have cultivated in a sense in a deliberate way, or that's just there? It's something that it's there without you're necessarily working on constructing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in putting the book together, I was thinking a lot about tone, probably more than anything else. And, you know, initially I had, you know, a manuscript that was twice as long with twice as many stories. And it was too big a book. It was about 20 stories. And I knew I had to pick and choose. And as I started picking stories, I was thinking partly about, you know, which stories went together thematically, but also which fit together tonally, because I wanted the book to have, you know, a consistent tone. Mm-hmm. And I wanted, you know, after a while I began to realize that, you know, a lot of these stories are very personal, very sort of intimate. There's a confessional quality to them. And so I began choosing stories that fit that tone. And so that's why the book sort of has that feel to it. It could have felt completely different had I chosen, you know, 10 different stories. But I wanted it, to feel even, so that it felt, you know, kind of unified in a way. Yeah.
Well, I suppose it does that in the sense that you definitely have this feeling that that one person wrote all these stories, but also in the sense that, you know, I don't know what kind of word that I would attach. Melancholy is probably the first one that comes to my mind. It is slightly tinged with sadness, but not in the sense that, as we said before, many of these stories are about people looking back to earlier events in their lives and asking those questions that everyone does about why things happened the way they did, and maybe coming to grips with the idea that we have so little control over the direction that our lives take. Things happen, and there's not too much you can do about that. And you can try later to make sense of them, but that's just not always possible.
Yeah. And, yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think there is, you know, the stories are largely about, you know, some form of absence and, you know, an mm-hmm. absence in these characters' lives because either because of something that has happened or someone who is no longer in their life or whatever. And whenever that is a theme, you're going to have there is going to be a tinge of melancholy or sadness mm-hmm. Because of that absence. Yeah.
And it's again, and it may be a matter of deliberate choice of picking the stories, but it seems to me certainly important. The important relationships here are within families. It's about parents and children, and it's about siblings.
Yeah, I think that many of the stories are about family. And again, as I was choosing them, I began to notice that theme, and so I was thinking, okay, you know, this story fits that theme. And you know, I think I've always been interested in family and the way that the members of a family interact with each other and, you know, the various types of dynamics that exist within a family. I've always been fascinated by that.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking for a while. We're about midway through. And here, I would ask you to read something, if you would, and maybe also I'll take the opportunity to introduce again our guest, Andrew Porter. He is Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at Trinity University. That's in San Antonio, Texas. He has contributed stories to a number of places. One Story, Epoch, the Pushcart Prize Anthology. He's also been featured on NPR's Selected Shorts. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop and is the author of the story collection, The Theory of Light and Matter, won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction 2007, published by the University of Georgia Press. He's here visiting in the area and will be doing a reading at the Alina Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus. So anybody who is interested should stop by. And now, why don't you, we've been talking about your writing. I'd like to give people a chance to hear some.
Sure. I'm going to read just a very brief excerpt from the opening of one of the stories, and the title of the story is Departure. That spring we were 16, Tanner and I started dating the Amish girls out on the rural highway, sometimes two or three at the same time, because it wasn't really dating. There was no way of getting serious. This was in 1992, over 10 years ago, and things had not yet begun to change in our part of Pennsylvania. I think of that year as a significant one now, a turning point in our county, the first year the town of Leola started growing and becoming a city, and also the first year the Amish started leaving, selling their property and heading west toward Indiana and Iowa. There had been several cases of runaways among the Amish that year, mostly young men, barely in their 20s, tempted by the shopping malls and bars popping up along the highways near their farms. Leola was expanding quickly then. It was becoming more common, and it worried the elders in the Amish community. And I think it explains why that spring some of the Amish teenagers were given permission to leave their farms for a few hours on Friday nights. Out on the other side of town, there was an intersection on the rural highway where they would go to hang out. It was a remote area, a strip mall with a Kmart sat on one side of the intersection, and across the road there was a 24-hour diner. You would sometimes see them on Friday evenings traveling in a long line like a funeral procession, their buggies hugging the shoulder of the road as tractor trailers rubbered by. They would park out of sight behind the Kmart, tie their horses to lampposts or the sides of dumpsters, and then the younger ones would go into the Kmart to play video games, and the older and more adventurous would cross the street to the diner. The diner was a family-style place, frequented only by local farming families and truckers, and it was usually empty. Inside, the Amish kids would immediately disappear into the bathrooms and change into blue jeans and T-shirts that they had bought at Kmart, clothes which never seemed to fit their bodies right. Then they would come out, their black wool clothes stuffed into paper bags, and order large platters of fried food and play country songs on the jukeboxes and try to pretend they weren't Amish.
This was a story particularly I wanted to ask you about it, and because one of the things I know about you is that you grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Right.
Which is Amish country. And I think it's an interesting story because as it begins, as you explain, and the two characters go there in part to meet Amish girls, and nothing improper happens, although one for them, as far as they were concerned, the fact that they were just talking to these boys, it was pretty improper.
Right.
You know, that was pretty like they were being on the edge. And it's interesting because in sort of my understanding is that within the Amish community, it's important that people voluntarily decide that they're going to live that life. So teenagers can be a little on the wild side. I think there are even some Amish teenage kids who have cars. They let them kind of do that because they want to make sure that when they make the decision, they're going to live the Amish lifestyle. That's sort of a voluntary decision. So it makes me want to believe that such a thing like this could happen. So is this actually based on something that you actually saw?
It is. You know, this is one of the stories that actually grew out of something from my own life that I observed, although I certainly, you know, didn't date Amish girls as a teenager. But you know, I grew up among the Amish. There are a lot of Amish in Lancaster. That's, you know, where the film Witness was made and so forth. And you know, when I was a teenager, I used to go to this sort of strip mall outside of town, you know, not far from where a lot of the Amish farms were. And there was, you know, a Kmart there, and there was an arcade inside where the kids would go to, you know, play video games, where we would go to play video games. And, you know, on Friday nights, occasionally these Amish teenagers would show up in street clothes. And, you know, it was obvious the clothes looked very new, and they were sort of not the right style, and you could just tell that they were Amish despite the fact they were trying very hard to blend in. Mm-hmm. And as a teenager, I didn't really understand what was happening. You know, I thought, this is very strange. I knew that these were Amish kids, but I didn't know why they were dressed this way or why they were suddenly playing Pac-Man, you know. And so later on, I learned that this was part of an experiment designed by their parents to sort of test their commitment to the Amish way of life, as you were saying. But that image always stayed with me, and there seemed to be something sad about it to me. And I remember my friends who were with me kind of laughing about it. But I remember just looking at those kids, and I just felt I felt sad for them for some reason. And, you know, so when I first started writing that story, it grew very much out of this image of this arcade, which didn't end up making its way into the story in the end. The early drafts of the story focused on this video, you know, arcade and so forth. But in the end, I realized that that wasn't the setting that I really wanted to write about. And the story kind of evolved from there. But it grew out of that initial image, and you know, I just, it had always kind of haunted me.
Yeah. Well, in this particular story, the two boys meet one girl and spend some time with her. And here is a character who really seems to be like teetering on the brink, like maybe she could go one way or another. And eventually that stays with her people. And you might indeed say, well, that was the only choice that she had. And I wonder whether in part, as you think about it now, your feeling of sadness was for the idea that these kids, in a sense, were trapped, that they really didn't have any choice. They really couldn't turn and walk away from their families and their life and everything that they had known and just get in the car and drive off. That just for them, as much as they might act like that was a choice, they really didn't. That really was really not a choice.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that they, you know, I think because they were teenagers and because these things were tempting as they'd be to any teenager, they were drawn toward it. And I think they sort of enjoyed getting away and having this time away. But I think they knew in the back of their mind that, you know, if they left, they would have nothing. They would have no money. They would have no family. They in many cases, wouldn't have the education to get a job. And they would be very much alone in the world. And so, I think in some ways that was the sadness that I perceived.
Yeah. That makes me think about something else that I think you see in a lot of these stories, and that is what I would call unlikely couples.
Right.
in a variety of ways, like the couple in The Theory of Light and Matter. Like there's another couple in a story and I hope I don't want to tell the story of all the stories, so then people would say, well, I don't need to go out and read that. I don't even know a story. Another sort of unlikely couple in a later story. And in a sense, also here, this unlikely couple, that one boy in particular and this Amish girl that seem really drawn to one another. Is there something in particular about mismatched people who maybe see in each other something, maybe feel some connection, and yet for a variety of reasons, that's just them being a couple is just not on, just not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that is something, I think that's true in a lot of the stories. I'm interested in relationships that really realistically, you know, can't happen. But on some level, characters who are very similar and who, you know, in some ways, have very similar internal conflicts that connect with each other in a very deep, very profound way and are drawn to each other despite the fact that they know they'll never be able to ultimately be together. And that's true of the title story. It's true of this story and a number of other stories in the book. I'm interested in that type of situation. Yeah.
So what about that? And certainly, I guess, if you're a writer, that gives you great opportunities to do things and to put your characters through things and seeing how they respond.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, I like presenting characters with difficult choices and, you know, difficult decisions. And that type of situation creates a lot of situations where they're forced to make difficult choices and difficult decisions. And, you know, in a way, I like to sort of test my characters. And I don't always know what's going to happen. You know, with that story, for example, I didn't know that they weren't going to end up together until it came to the end. And then I realized there was something inevitable about the fact that they couldn't be together. But I like to test the characters to see what they'll do. And, you know, sometimes I'm surprised and sometimes not.
Yeah, I like hearing you say that, and I guess that's the kind of thing I'm sure that I've talked about with other writers, and that, again, I'm sure that some people, when they hear writers say that, you know, the thing that so many writers say where they say, well, I wasn't really sure how this story was going to end, or that I start out and I create these characters and I have some idea about who they are and what they're going to do, but then they do things that surprise me. And I'm sure that people say, no, wait a minute. Now, how can that possibly be? You're the writer. You're writing the story. You create the characters. You really mean that you start out and you have some characters and you put them in a particular situation and you sort of set the story in motion. You really mean to tell me that you don't know how this story is going to end?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, Flannery O'Connor herself, you know, always talked about writing being an act of discovery. And she was someone who would just start with a sentence and kind of have no idea where the story was going and just follow the characters. And for me, that's the fun of writing. If I had it all mapped out ahead of time or plotted out or outlined, there would be no reason for me to write it. I write to discover what will happen, and that's the exciting part of writing, because oftentimes what you think is going to happen, or even sometimes what you want to happen, is not what happens in the story. If you find yourself trying to sort of impose, you know, a plot element on this story that doesn't fit with what the characters would really do or what the characters really want, it's going to feel artificial. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, that is something that excites me about writing a story.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Andrew Porter. His book, it's a collection of stories. It's The Theory of Light and Matter, won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction 2007, published by the University of Georgia Press. He teaches writing at Trinity University, San Antonio, Texas, and he's here visiting here in our area. He's going to be doing a book signing, a reading and book signing this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Illini Union Bookstore. So if you're interested, you can stop by there. Also, if you'd like to find out more about him, he has a website, andrewporterwriter.com. That's all run together, so you can take a look at that. And, of course, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I was really interested in, we talked a little bit about the story about the Amish kids going into town and changing clothes and trying on a little bit of a different way of living, and about this, the meeting of the boys, particularly one boy with an Amish girl, and this sort of bond, this connection develops. And that's in a sense based on something that you actually did see, you know, when you were growing up, because you grew up where there were a lot of Amish people living. And I like the idea that story is rooted in something that actually happened to you, or that you actually saw. That gets me thinking about, well, other ways in which, and other particular ways in which you would say that you're, having said before that the characters in the stories, they're not directly based on your family, your friends, people you know, but other ways that particular stories, you know, something that happens to you or has happened to you ends up being the seed, and that the story grows from that.
Yeah, you know, people always, you know, assume that I come up with an idea for a story, and when I tell them actually where the stories come from, it's surprising to them, because usually the stories will grow out of an image, and usually that image is something from my past. In the case of that story, obviously it was the image of that arcade and those Amish kids that story grew out of. But with each of the stories, it always starts with some image that for some reason intrigues me or haunts me. In the title story, for example, it was just a very sort of simple image, but it was an image of me sitting in college, taking an exam on a sort of snowy winter day, and staring out the window and looking at the snow when I was supposed to be taking this exam and being kind of, you know, distracted by it. And, you know, it's just a strange image. Why did that stick in my mind? I don't know. But I started writing about it, and pretty soon that story was being narrated by a young woman who was taking a nearly impossible physics exam, and then it turned into something else entirely, and it turned into this story about this relationship. But it really grew out of this very simple, strange image from my past that for whatever reason just stayed with me. And so I feel like if an image stays with you, there's usually a reason for that, and oftentimes there's a story behind it. And that's where most of my stories come from.
Yeah. This the theory of light and matter, this is the story that you're talking about, this story that ends up being about this relationship between an older male physics professor and a young student, where clearly these two people see something in each other, and an important bond develops. And they end up spending a lot of time together. They clearly like spending time together. There is no physical consummation of this relationship. And I think that both of them realize that that what they have, that is the fact that they do get to spend time together, that they really like one another, and that there is some kind of a bond, they realize, well, that's what it's going to be. And that when the time comes for that to end, I think they both recognize that, well, that's, you know, that is going to be the end. It has to be the end. It seems that, you know, a lot of these stories do have to do with intimate relationships between people. What do you think it is truly that makes that happen? I mean, do you have some sort of thought about what it is that causes two people to, you know, see something in one another? And even if this is one of those unlikely couple relationships that are in these stories, that doesn't stop them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we connect with people for a variety of reasons. And oftentimes the people that we connect with are not always the people, you know, they're not always people our same age or, you know, people who that we would expect to connect with. And that's just another example of that, where those two characters, I think, shared a bond. I mean, they were connected on some pretty deep level, but because of the nature of their relationship and the age difference and so forth, that was not going to be consummated. But yet it was a very intimate type of relationship. And I think in that story in particular, I was very interested in exploring a very intimate type of friendship between two people who I kind of sensed were never going to really be together. And, you know, I thought, you know, this would be an interesting type of dynamic to explore. And in many ways, you know, Heather, the narrator of that story, is much more connected to this older man than she is to her husband, despite the fact that her husband seems like the perfect fit for her. He's her age. He's, you know, very similar to her in superficial ways, but not on a deeper level.
Yeah. I have a caller here when we get to. I want to correct something, and I have said now several times I've given the time of your reading, and I've been giving it wrong, so I want to correct it. It is at 4:30,
yes,
not 4 o'clock. Now, you know, maybe if people would have shown up at 4, they've been willing to hang around for a half an hour before it started. But please do, if you want to take the opportunity to meet and hear more from our guest and reporter. He will be doing a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore today, 4:30.
That's right.
All right. Good. Well, I'm glad we got that right now. Let's talk with, we have a caller I want to talk with, someone in the community of Belgium over by Danville, our toll-free line here, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, and hello to you. The question I'd like to ask, or the observation I'd like to make, is one that I've noticed over the years. I have several friends who are writers and journalists, and I have friends who are artists and musicians, and it seems the whole group of people in this genre have a view and an attitude of some of the rest of us in a way, and I've kind of wondered if it's universal or if you notice it, or maybe it's just me. They seem to think that writing is the ultimate act, okay? Meaning that it's the best profession to be. If you're an athlete, well, you don't really put out the same effort to become an athlete as a person who has to write a story. Same way with an artist. Like, in my work, I deal with wood a lot, and you wouldn't consider me an artist, but it's taken years and years for me to develop the talents I have. But yet, I'm not looked upon in the same way as an artist would be, who might work as a sculptor in wood, completely different. And I'm wondering, why do English majors always take this point of view, or artists or musicians, that if you don't develop a long effort to produce a book, it's not the same as somebody taking years and years to become a basketball player, when essentially that's the same effort.
I wish I could have been a basketball player.
Well, me too. you understand what I'm saying. I mean, in many cases, I've had discussions with people, and they just really disparage people who are athletes, saying, oh, they take the easy way out. Well, no, they don't. They put a lot of effort in becoming a basketball player or a football player or a baseball player. Now, it's not intellectual, but it's definitely a physical effort. And And I noticed that in a lot of writing. Maybe I can't speak for yourself or universally, but you probably have noticed the same thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I know what you're saying. I admire people in any number of fields, including sports, and any number of fields. But I'm a writer. Really, I feel in some ways like I didn't have a choice in the matter. That this was something that I just became drawn toward, I never really had a choice in the matter. So I don't really think of it as in any way superior to anything anyone else is trying to do. It's just what I happen to be drawn toward.
Well, maybe I'm just not phrasing the concept I'm trying to put out quite properly. So thank you very much, sir.
All right. Well, we have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Andrew Porter. His collection of stories, The Theory of Light and Matter. I suppose that one of the things that the caller makes me think about is that that writing really is a craft. I think of artfully constructing a story can be seen in the same way of building a beautiful piece of furniture. And maybe again, if you're not a writer, you don't see the way things are put together. Maybe. As maybe you do when you read somebody else's work, but that it seems to me that it's as much a craft as it is an art, and particularly when you think about how much work can really go into writing a piece. And again, as I said before, when we see it, it's finished. We don't see everything that's gone into it. I mean, in the same way, I guess, if you look at a beautiful piece of furniture, I mean, you really don't, you see the finished piece and you don't see how much sweat. Both sweat and inspiration went into it.
Yeah, it's very much a craft, and it's a lot of hard work, and it's not very glamorous when you're doing it. I think that people romanticize the writing life, and when you see the way writers are portrayed, say in movies, they have inspiration, they sit down at their typewriters, and they write their novel in a flurry, and that is how writers have been portrayed, in film and television and so forth. But it's really, it is a craft. It's a lot of hard work, and it's a lot of days spent just kind of going over paragraphs, going over sentences, rereading. It's a lot of hard work. I'd say in some ways maybe more craft than art.
Yeah. And solitary work. It's so much of the time it's you staring at the paper or the word processor, however it is, whatever it is you use to write.
Yeah, it is. I mean, again, that's something, and I tell this to my students who want to go on and have careers as writers. Again, I think they're sort of drawn toward what seems like the more glamorous side of being a writer, and they have this romantic idea of what being a writer would be. But, I explained to them, it's a lot of time alone at your desk. It's a very solitary life. It can be a difficult life. And, you need to be prepared for that. You need to be comfortable with the fact that it is something that you're going to be doing on your own.
Mm-hmm. Do you think I'm going back to the comment of the caller, that we somehow undervalue people whose art is expressed with their bodies, whether that's an athlete or a dancer or whatever, and somehow we do, and maybe that's within the within the arts community or within the college, that we somehow tend to think of the people who do the brain work as being superior to people who do the body work.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a culture, perhaps we do that, or certain people do that, but I've certainly never done that. I mean, I have such deep admiration for athletes growing up, as a avid fan of many sports. I would never undervalue the amazing things that they are able to do.
Well, we're about the point where we're going to have to finish here. If you'd like to read the stories, they're good, and I would suggest that you go out and look for the book, The Theory of Light and Matter. It's a collection of stories by our guest, Andrew Porter, won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction 2007. Andrew Porter is Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and he is here in Champaign-Urbana and will be giving a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30. So please, I'm glad finally to get that right. 4:30 this afternoon, and of course, otherwise you can if you can't hear him or see him, you can go out and look for the book, The Theory of Light and Matter. Well, thanks very much. We appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.